So, when we're in yeshiva, we know that there are all sorts of laws, lessons that we could learn out of a pasuk, out of a piece of a pasuk. If you've learned makas kasher, zamum, lasos, la'achiv, I mean, it's like chock full of things we can learn out of it. Sometimes we could learn something from an extra hey, or an extra vav, or a lamed, or a mem. But sometimes what we don't realize, we may overlook, is that there are all sorts of things that if we steig into a story in Tanakh, we can also learn many, many things. If there is a story that Hashem took pains to include in the Torah, it's because there's a lesson. It's like sometimes people wonder, I'm facing this terrible test. I don't know if I can pass it. You know what? You can. How do I know that? Because you're having a test. Hashem doesn't give tests to people unless they can pass it. Doesn't mean you're going to, but you can. So Hashem did not put the story, for example, of Yosef in the Torah because we'll make a great Broadway show, Joseph in Technicolor Dreamcoat. Oh, this will be great. Andrew Lloyd Webber will write the lyrics. He didn't put the story of Yetzias Mitzrayim in the Torah because it'll be a great cartoon or animation. Spielberg will do Prince of Egypt. This is going to be fantastic. He put them in there because we're supposed to learn lessons from them. So I want to take you through a story in the Torah that happens very quickly. And it happens so quickly that A, if you blink, you miss it. And B, it's just kind of like out of the blue and weird and doesn't lead to anything. And so it almost, I don't want to say seems like filler, but it's one of those where like, I don't know, maybe you come up with a quick lesson and you move on. And I think that's a mistake. So I want to go through it with you. So what happens, just to set the scene, is that Hashem tells Avraham, when Avraham is 99 years old, I need you to do a mitzvah. It's called Bris Milah. Henceforth, from now on, every Jewish baby boy at 8 days old is going to have a bris. Oh, and by the way, I want you to mal yourself. He's 99 years old, okay? That's a big ask. But and he actually consults his friends. And after consulting with them, he decides he's going to do it. He does it. If it were us, if it were me, I'm not 99. Even at my age, I'd be in bed, I don't know for how long, okay? Putting in room service, having my wife, please, hon, can you bring me whatever, up to my room. But it's Avraham. So on the third day, which is the most painful day, instead of sitting in bed, waiting for Sarah to bring him food and drink, he is outside his tent. He's not just outside his tent. He's looking for guests because it's Avraham, right? Third day after his bris, at 99 years old, he's looking for guests. So what's Hashem going to do? He's got to send them guests. Okay, go grab a few malachim, Raphael and Mikhail and Gavriel. Go visit him. Each one has a job. Interesting, just a side note, there are actually four jobs. But Uriel was not around. It wasn't his day off. Uriel was not introduced into the world until Matan Torah. That's why he's not around. If you're wondering why Rashi says that there were four jobs and three angels, so one of them had to do double duty. So he sends the three malachim. The job of one of them is to tell Avraham that this year, this time of year, next year, at this time, I'm going to return, and Sarah, your wife, is going to have a son. So this is where we pick it up. It says, Vahine ven l'sari ishtecha, Sarah, your wife, will have a son. V'sarah shomas pesach ha'ohel. So Sarah happened to overhear this because she's at the doorway of the tent, not because she's eavesdropping. Avraham had asked her to prepare the food, so she's going in and out, bringing in the food, the drink. So she happens to be right there, and she overhears this. V'hi achareh, that was behind him. In other words, he's facing this way, so she's at the entrance of the tent that's behind him when she overhears the malach, not knowing it's a malach. The Torah then tells us, V'avraham v'sarah zikenim. Avram and Sarah were old, boyim bayamim, well on in years. Chada lios l'sara orech kanashim. This is a euphemistic way of saying Sarah no longer had the way of women. What that means is that the Torah is telling us now, it's made. It was not physically, biologically, anatomically possible for her to have a child. She is 89 years old, not possible. It might have been possible earlier, that's some debate as to her physiology, but it was certainly the Torah's telling us it's not possible for her to have a child. Somebody just said, next year she's going to have a son. Next, Vatitzchak Sarah Bekirba. Sarah laughed to herself, Lamar, saying, Achre Velosi, now that I'm worn out, V'haisa li Edna, shall I have the pleasure of a son? V'adoni Zakein, and my husband's also old. V'yomer Hashem el Avraham, Hashem says to Avram. So Hashem appears on the scene and says to Avraham, not to Sarah, says to Avraham, Loma zetzachaka Sarah. Why did Sarah laugh? Lamar saying, Ha'af umnam eled vani zakanti. Can I really give birth when I'm old? Now, I have to introduce somebody. Introduce my best friend, but I have to give you a little bit of background before I do that. So there was a fellow who was born in France and then got a stellar learning with a Rav in Worms, Germany. And that's when he began to rise to prominence. He was convinced to return to France. He went back to Troyes, Jewish population of about 100. This is about 1,000 years ago. And he starts writing, and his writings became very well known. He has a household name. His name is Rabbi Peter Parker. Okay, I'm sure you all have heard of him. I'm kidding, sort of. His name is Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki Rashi, right? So why do I call him Peter Parker? Which, by the way, is high praise. This is not meant as any slight. Rashi is by far my best friend. I spend more time with him than any other friend. I call him Peter Parker because Peter Parker, Spider-Man, has spidey sense. So he can sense something that's about to happen and it starts tingling. So Rashi's unerring spidey sense when something's going on, he grabs it and he's right there on it. So he realizes, we may have missed this, maybe, unless we're reading carefully, but Rashi's on it, he copped it, saw it, he's going to tell us why. He says, he quotes Hashem saying, Vanizakanti, he says, Shina Hakasav, the Torah changed things, Mibnei Hashalom, because of peace. Why? Sharehi Amra Vadoni Zakein, because she said, and my husband's old. Now in court, as lawyers, we ask people to swear, or if it's a frumiyah, to affirm that they're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That's all important. Why don't you say, I hereby affirm to tell the truth? Because what Hashem said was the truth. She did say, can I have a kid when I'm old? But he didn't tell the whole truth. He left out, he shortened her statement, he left out the part about Avram being old. Interesting. Okay, back into the psukim. Hashem continues. Hayipolim Hashem Dover, is there anything too far removed from Hashem? Lamoid Ashuv Elecha. At the appointed time, I will return to you. Ka'es Chaya Losara Ven. At this time of life, and Sarah will have a son. Hashem exits stage left, and apparently, Avraham approaches Sarah and must have said to her in between psukim, Sarah, you know, were you laughing at something? At something? The next pasuk, Vatichachi, Sarah denies it. Lamar saying, Lo tzachachti, I did not laugh. Ki yareah, because she was afraid. Vayomer, Avram responds, Lo, no, ki tzachacht, you did laugh. Here we go. If you're taking notes, here are the lessons. You ready? Lesson number one. When you start a fight between two people, telling somebody, you know, what somebody else said, and maybe they're going to get upset, don't start a full war. It's enough. Just start like a minor skirmish. You know, Hashem, he knows he's about to start a fight between a married couple. He could have really, really dug it in. Yeah, and she piled on. She called you old coot. He didn't do that. He just enough to start a fight, but not a really big fight. That's lesson number one, okay? I'll give you an example of this. A number of years ago, I got my credit card bill, and I found out, Mazel Tov, that I had purchased $3,000 worth of tractor equipment from a company in Lexington, Kentucky. I asked my wife, I was pretty sure. She said, I'm pretty sure that I didn't buy that. So I called the credit card company. Turns out somebody got our number and bought $3,000 worth of tractor supplies in Lexington, Kentucky. They canceled the credit card, they credited it back, and they said, you know what we can do is we can put an alert on your card, and let's say, like, if there's any purchase over $500, it'll automatically send you an email. So if you get that and it's not yours, call us right away, and that way we can, you know, avoid it. We can avoid the transaction right away. You want us to do that? I said, sure, okay? So great, so they started doing that. So I come home from work, sit down to dinner, I'll sit on my wife. So, was there a sale at Bloomingdale's today? She's like, you got to be kidding me, okay? So she just loves when they whisper in my ear whenever she puts more than $500 in the credit card. Okay, lesson number two. Lesson number two is, we get this from Sarah Imenu, Sarah the matriarch, the first matriarch. It is, guys, you ready? It is okay to lie if you're scared. I mean, normally, midvar sheker tirchak, but if you're scared, it's okay to lie. We've got Sarah. She lied. She says, I did not laugh. Sarah, I mean, you laughed. I got it in the last pasuk. I mean, you're dead to rights. We caught you red-handed, right? But she's afraid. It's okay to lie. And the third one, this is my favorite lesson. The third one is that when you are in an argument with someone, guys, don't ever forget this. You get the last word in. You see Avraham right here. He's like, no, you did laugh. Go get him, big guy. You tell her. That's right. That's right. He walks away. And that's the end of the story, okay? Those are our three lessons. And obviously, I am joking. That is completely ridiculous and preposterous. Those are not lessons. That's foolishness. So what should set off your spidey sense, if there are any Peter Parkers in the room, is that what's so weird about the story is that every actor in the story is acting exactly against type. Hashem is starting a fight? Hashem's name is Shalom. Hashem's starting a fight between a married couple? Hashem, you have a beef with Sarah. You're upset that Sarah laughed. You're of course right. Go talk to Sarah. Why are you talking to Abraham? Sarah lies because she's afraid. Afraid of what? Afraid of whom? Abraham? Did you notice in other places in the Torah, Sarah being afraid of Abraham? You know, did she back down? Oh, by the way, Abraham, I got your chore list for today. Let's see. Kick Hagar and Yishmael out of the house. Oh, I'm sorry. What was that first chore? Yeah. Kick Hagar and Yishmael out of the house. But I'm Abraham. I'm like the epitome of chesed. Like, what do you mean? I kicked him out of the house. Hashem, listen to your wife, okay? When did she back down? All of a sudden now she can't admit, yeah, I laughed because there was a knucklehead in your tent telling you that I'm going to have a son when I'm 89 and it's not physically possible. Yes, I laughed, okay? What next, Avraham, right? And the last one, Avraham's getting the last word in. That's his meat is chesed. What is he doing? What in the world is he doing? And why is the Torah telling us this? What is the point of him responding, we know she laughed. What in the world is going on? So, there are mafarshim that touch on this. This bothered me tremendously. There's one parish that says that maybe the reason that Hashem went to Avraham and not Sarah is that it wouldn't have been modest because she's a woman. Lo nehirali. I respect. I'm sure the person who said that has much broader shoulders than me. It just that shot doesn't speak to me because you see elsewhere that Sarah clearly had nevoah. So I don't cop that one. But that's one approach. There's another approach. Another parish says no. It's not Avraham that went to speak to her when it says that she denied it because she was afraid, and he said no, you did laugh. It's Hashem speaking to her. Yeah, but that still creates the problem. If it's Hashem speaking to her, then why did Hashem go to Avraham in the first place? Just go to Sarah if you're going to go speak to her later. Most Mefarshim agree that it is Avraham. So I have a mahalach. I don't know if I'm right. But if I'm wrong, come up with another one. Because I think you have to figure out what in the world is going on here and what can we learn from it. So here's what I want to suggest. First of all, maybe, and I say this only half-jokingly, maybe we're shown here by Hashem in the Torah, that there's a purpose for everything. Like, you may ask yourselves, you may wonder, especially if you're not one, I hope you're not, why did Hashem create yentas? Like, what do they really bring to the table? Like, do we really need, yentas? Like, do we need people that are, that are up on the hawk and spreading the hawk? Is that really, like, what does that add to the world? So I'll tell you a story. I run our Manhattan office, and I work with my three younger brothers. And my parents are in Philly, though now they're spending more time in our Lakewood office. They just moved there. You should live and be well. So we were moving our Manhattan office from our building, it's across the street from Macy's, 34th and 7th, from the 11th floor to the 44th floor. So it's the same building. So what we were doing was, the day before the move, or a few days before the move, we were throwing out stuff that didn't need to go, deciding which furniture to take and not to take. And so the day before the move, my father happened to be visiting the New York office. And we have a mincha minyan, or at least we did until, for decades, until Corona, we haven't been able to start it up again, hopefully soon. And so my father left for the day, and after he left, he called me. I was still in the office, and the mincha minyan was maybe 4 o'clock, so now it's like 6 o'clock or so. My father calls, he says, oh, I forgot to mention this to you. He said, you're taking my stuff upstairs, right? My father had in his New York office maybe his New York diplomas, he had some pictures, he had some things that he'd gotten from honorariums. And so I said, Dad, of course I'm taking your stuff. What do you think I'm doing with it? He said, yeah, of course I thought that. He goes, it was just very weird. One of the guys in the minyan came up to me after minyan, and he said, by the way, your boys are throwing your stuff away. He's like, you're not throwing my stuff away. I was like, Dad, of course we're not throwing your stuff away. It'll be in a position of honor in the new office. Great. I hang up the phone. I say to myself, I really better check. So I go out of the office into the freight elevator area. They had given us this big bin from the building. And they said, whatever you're throwing out, just fill up the bin and we'll get rid of it. So I walk in, I take a look in the bin. Oh my goodness. The bin is filled all my father's, his diplomas, paintings, the honoraria. Mike, I cannot believe this. I take each one, I make a bunch of trips, I bring it back into the office. I call our filing clerk. I was like, dude. He's like, what? What's going on? I was like, you threw out my father's stuff. He's like, what are you talking about? No, I didn't. I said, I just took it out of the bin in the freight elevator area. He says, oh no, my cousin was in. He was helping me, or my nephew, whatever it was. He goes, he must have misunderstood. I told him to keep that pile. He must have thought I said to throw it away. Now, here's the question. The guy who told this to my father is a guy who works in New York, who davens in our minyan, in our mincha minyan, every single day. It's a guy that I know well. My father visits once every couple of weeks, 2-3 weeks. Why didn't the guy come up to me and say, Harry, you're throwing your father's stuff away. There's got to be a mistake, right? Why do you go to my father, right, which is going to make me look bad? And the answer is, because it's no fun to whisper it to me. What's the fun in that? Harry, there's a mistake. But to whisper to my father, you know your boys are throwing your stuff away. That's fun, okay? So bli ayin hara, thank God for yentas, or we would have thrown my father's stuff away, okay? But I still don't think that that's what's going on. So here's what I think maybe is what's going on. Maybe Avraham and Sarah have a different view with respect to how Hashem interacts with the Bria. Maybe Avraham feels Hashem can do anything, and at any given moment, he might do anything, meaning that if he decides, for whatever reason he has, to make an open miracle, let's call it a nes nigla prati, an individual one, to make an individual, just decide, you start flying. You know, you have, you know, heat vision, you, whatever it is, you start scaling walls, right? He can do an open miracle for an individual, in addition to the massive miracles that he does worldwide. Whereas maybe Sarah feels, of course Hashem can do an open miracle for an individual, but that's not the way he interacts with the Bria. If he does a miracle, that's a worldwide thing. Creation, worldwide miracle. The flood, worldwide miracle. Dor HaFloga, the dispersion, worldwide miracle. But he's not going to make an open miracle for an individual. He's not going to interrupt the Bria and turn it around and have a 99-year-old man and an 89-year-old woman have a child. So maybe Hashem is coming to Avraham, saying, Avraham, is there anything that I can't do? Which is rhetorical. When did Avraham ever say, well, Hashem, let me think about that. I don't know. Can you make the Jets win a Super Bowl? I mean, I don't know. There might be something. Like, Avraham never said there's something Hashem can't do. But maybe what Hashem is suggesting to Avraham is, Avraham, why would Sarah laugh? The reason she laughed may be that she doesn't think that I'll do an open miracle for an individual. So I'm talking to you. Now, why would Avraham know, not think, know that Hashem does open miracles for individuals? Why? Because when he was a kid, we know what happened, right? He was 12 years old or so, according to most of the Mefarshim. And his father leaves him in charge. Terach leaves him in charge of the shop, which is an idol-making shop. His father wasn't just an idolater. He made idols. And he comes home that day, and every idol is destroyed. They're in pieces. There's rubble on the ground. He says, hey, what in the world's going on? Like, what happened? He says, Dad, it was crazy. Like, they got into a fight. Like, first the little ones started hitting each other, and then the big ones hit the medium ones, and then the big ones, like, whomped each other, and they broke each other apart. He says, Avraham, what are you talking about? Idols don't have power. They can't actually fight with each other. And he said, then, Dad, respectfully, why do you worship them instead of the one God above? His father said, okay, wise guy, let's go talk to the king. So he takes him to Nimrod, tells Nimrod what's going on. Nimrod says, oh, okay, you believe in your God? Let's check and see how powerful he is. I'm going to have you walk through a furnace. And he sends young Avraham through the furnace, and Avraham walks out of the furnace unscathed. That is an open miracle for an individual. There is no pyrotechnics. Steven Spielberg, George Lucas was not there. They didn't do it through CGI. He walked through a fire and came out on the other side. It's absolutely unbelievable. So Hashem may be suggesting to Avraham, Avraham, why is it that she doesn't believe I'll do an open miracle for an individual? She doesn't realize that I will. You know I will. Avraham, did you never tell her a certain story? I think maybe it's time that you shared that story with her. So now Avraham approaches Sarah. Sarah, did you just overhear something and laugh? And Sarah denies it. So all the Torah tells us is she denies it. Now, as a lawyer, I can tell you there are approximately 500 ways that you could deny something. I can tell you this from depositions, right? It doesn't matter what it says in the police report. The guy in the police report could say, you know, officer, I'm so, you know, driver of vehicle number 2 states, officer, I am so sorry. I was drinking my coffee while changing the radio station, while texting with my other hand, and I didn't see the person and I rear-ended him. It gets to the deposition, it's no, I didn't mean that. I didn't say that. It wasn't me. It was somebody else. I was whatever, okay? You could deny it all sorts of ways. Maybe Sarah is issuing a soft denial. Me? Laugh? I didn't laugh. Why? Because she's afraid. Because every husband and wife knows, even friends know this, right? There's certain topics you don't bring up. There's certain things that are just too painful. She's afraid, Avraham, I don't know what you're doing, okay? Please don't do this to me. Do you understand? You know this. When I was in my 20s, in my 30s, in my 40s, maybe it could still happen in my 50s, but 60s, 70s, 80s, like there came a time when it was no longer possible. Don't play around. You can't go there. She's terrified. Like, Avram, how could you sport with this, right? And he says to her, not because he's getting the last word in, not because this is a fight. This is an incredible moment of closeness between one of the avos and one of the imahos. He says, Sarah, you laughed. I want you to sit down. I have to share with you a story that I've never told you before, how Hashem once did an open miracle for me, and he's going to do another open miracle for us, and next year at this time, we are going to be holding a son. And he tells her for the first time the story of the Kibshon Ha'esh. Now you may say to me, how is it possible that all these years she was married? She was two at the time, according to most Mepharshim. So she was married for 87 years to Mr. Miracle and never knew it. How is that possible? So I'm going to tell you why, because I have a theory about this too. The story of the Kibshon Ha'esh did not end with Avraham walking through the furnace. Avraham had another brother who was there. His other brother was there. His name was Haran. Nimrod said to Haran, all right, buddy, who do you believe in? Abraham's God or our gods? And Haran said, give me a minute. And he waited to see what would happen to Avraham. Avraham walks through unscathed, and Haran says, I believe in Avraham's God. Nimrod says, you're next. Sticks him in the furnace, and he gets incinerated. He dies. Now, massive Kiddush Hashem. I'd like to believe that all of us, after watching Avraham walk through, would have said, yes, Avraham's God, but, I mean, you still got to walk through the furnace, right? He died. Maybe because he wasn't at the level of Avraham. He waited. Avraham didn't wait. He could have said right away, I believe in Avraham's God. He waited to see. So maybe he didn't merit that open miracle, but he still died through a massive Kiddush Hashem. But maybe Avraham fell. She's 2 years old. I don't want anybody in my group, Eliezer or my other servants, please don't ever tell her the whole story. We're just going to tell her father died, I'll Kiddush Hashem. I don't want her to hear, because psychologically it could be damaging. Yeah, you know, that her husband made it and her father didn't, you know, wasn't quite at the same level. I don't want to tell her that story. So you'll say, okay, fine. There was no internet, but wasn't Al Jazeera publishing its newspaper? Why didn't the rest of the world hear the story? And why wouldn't she have heard it through Scuttlebutt, through some Yenta? You're married to Avraham? That's the miracle guy, right? And that I can answer easily. Because back then, when Nimrod was running the world and there was no internet and no newspapers, I can assure you that Nimrod announced to the crowd, whatever you think you just saw didn't happen. In Las Vegas, they have a phrase. It's like, you know, they try to convince people to go there and do things that they shouldn't do. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. They once tried to change it to, what happens in Vegas didn't happen. Like, because what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas means you might still have charata about it, even though nobody's going to know about it. What happens in Vegas didn't happen. You don't even need to have charata. It didn't happen, right? So Nimrod's saying, what you think just happened, it didn't happen. If I find out that anybody repeats this story, I will start by cutting off your fingers and your toes, and I will work up from there. There is no way that Nimrod let this terribly embarrass. This kid showed him up. So it's very possible that she never heard the story. So what are our real takeaways? Number one, you have to see how careful you have to be with the feelings of others. Hashem needs to talk to Avraham, because Hashem realizes, if my theory is right, Avraham's the problem, not Sarah. Sarah didn't know this. Avraham knows it. I got to talk to him so that he'll talk to her. He'll know how to do it sensitively. But in order to do this, I don't need to repeat the whole quote. I don't need to tell him that she also said that he's old. It's just enough to tell him that she laughed and said, how can I have a kid when I'm old? That's how careful he has to be. And nowadays, Winston Churchill once said this after the British defended the attacks on the Germans. He said, never before in the history of human events have so few done so much for so many. So I will tell you that nowadays, never before in history has it been so easy for so few to embarrass people in front of so many with so little effort, right? You're on a group email, you're in a group text, you're in a group WhatsApp chat, and somebody says something a little spicy and it hurts your feelings, and you gotta give it back. I mean, you gotta give it back with both barrels. Mark Twain once wrote a book of essays, okay? A little spicy. He called it A Pen Dipped in Hell. That was the name of the title of his essays, okay? So you gotta dip your pen in hell and you gotta give it back. Why do you have to give it back publicly? If it's on WhatsApp, just hold it for an extra second and you'll get the option. Reply privately. If it's an email, just click reply, not reply all. If it's a text, just send a separate text. So you'll say, of course I have to do it publicly. They embarrassed me publicly. Oh, that's great. So now in addition to publicly embarrassing them, you're also taking revenge. So you're over two different Isurim instead of one. Just take it easy. Write to them. First, calm down. Sleep on it. Let the smoke start stop coming out of your ears. Be down the cuffs, and then write a private message. You know what you said. I don't know if you realized it. It was very hurtful. It was very insulting. You know, I just want to let you know that, and you'll see that much more likely you'll get an apology than if you embarrass them in public and then expect them to apologize when you may well embarrass them in fashion that was worse than what they did to you. And it's particularly important right before Yom Kippur, because sometimes we make the mistake of thinking that, you know, it was Yom Kippur, and I did my tshuva, and I did my tefillah, and I did my, you know, our version of our Hail Marys, I did a bunch of these. In fact, you know, my chest is hurting, I did so many, and I gave some tzedakah, so I'm good, and that is half right. But it's not the whole truth, because if you wronged somebody else, there's no, Hashem doesn't make up. Yeah, as between you and Hashem, he'll forgive you, but not between you and the other person. And we, when we do something wrong, we have so many excuses. No, I didn't mean it. I was sick that day. I was tired that day. I was distracted that day. And you really mean it. Like, you have real excuses. But when somebody else has the same excuse, no. That is unforgivable. I cannot accept that. Like, just accept the same excuses that you have. But the bigger takeaway is that Hashem does miracles for individuals. And the question that we all have to ask ourselves is, do we believe that? Do we believe that Hashem does individual miracles? So I will tell you that if you look for them, you'll see them constantly. There are things that happen but through the laws of statistics, it's just not possible that this could happen. It's like Hashem is playing that game I play with my little grandkids now. I get to play it again. My kids are too old now, but the grandkids are young enough. You know, we play peekaboo, and they love it. It's the greatest game. So Hashem sometimes actually plays peekaboo. It's like he peeks out from behind the curtain. How you doing? And he's right there. It's like, that was insane. So I'll tell you a story. So 2 years ago, I was leading a Kirov trip in Eretz Yisrael for married Jewish men between their like mid-30s and mid-50s, and you know, without any Jewish background. And one of the guys on the trip had lost his son. The trip was in October of 2018. He had lost his son in February of 2018 in the Parkland shooting. One of the most horrifying, you can't wrap, and I do this for a living, where people get a phone call and they get the news that their you know, wife and or husband or mother or father, brother, sister, son, daughter, that a mad guy gets a call that his son was gunned down by some lunatic student in high school. He was the first victim in the Parkland slaying. So this is very raw. This is only months. I'm sure it's always going to be raw. So he's in Eretz Yisrael. It's very difficult. I tried my best to speak to him. When I took the guys to the hotel, and I explained to them that we have a tradition. If you'd like to do this, we're going to give out pens and paper. I gave a whole talk about tefillah and explained to them this is a chance. Like, you can write a note and stick it in the wall to our Father in Heaven. So he wrote a note. He showed it to his city leader, the rabbi who was leading his trip, who told me this because, you know, he felt that he didn't mind because he was telling the rabbi this. He wrote one thing on his note. He wrote the word, why? ? Put it in the wall. I mean, where do you begin? Okay? That was on a Wednesday night. Why? Sticks it in the wall. Friday, I'm at the at the hotel with the guys, and we're dancing, and I get a tap on the shoulder. Oh, of course, it always happens in the, you know, at the hotel. Either it's, you know, it could be anybody. It could be Eliyahu Navi. It could be an old friend. In this instance, it happened to be an old friend. So it's Rabbi Levi Shem Tov. He runs the Chabad Embassy in Washington, D.C., a childhood classmate. And I, you know, give him a big hug, because that was back when we were allowed to still hug each other. And I say, you know, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I know why you're here. You're here for the wedding. I'm so sorry I couldn't make it. He made a wedding that week, but I couldn't get away from the guys. We had an activity, whatever, that night. So he says, listen, stop by. He says, where are you having dinner? I said, oh, we're having dinner in the H building right up the top of the stairs. He said, okay, I'm going to give you the address. After your meal, stop by. I'm sure we'll still be going late. Stop by at the Shev Brachas. I said, okay, fine, great. For some reason, which I still don't understand, I mean, I know why, but it just didn't make sense at the time. Levi then shows up at the dinner, like we already made up. He comes over my table and says hello. I think he showed up because he knew the woman that runs the organization for whom I was doing this trip. So he went in to say hi to her. And so he says to me, okay, remember the address? I got it. I'll stop by. Fine. He leaves, okay? So this, the woman, before he leaves, the woman who's running the trip says, "Oh, by the way, I just want to tell everybody, we have a, you know, the woman who's, who is in charge of the organization, she says, "I want to, you know, just tell everybody, we have a celebrity sighting. Rabbi Levi Shem Tov is here. He runs Chabad. Everybody knows Chabad in Washington. Everybody wave to Levi. Levi waves. If you need anything in D.C., he's one of the most well-connected guys in D.C., which he is. He's the guy who, he koshers the White House kitchen for the Hanukkah party every year. So Levi leaves. Max, the father who lost the son in the Parkland shooting, comes up to me and he says, "Wait, is that rabbi still here?" I said, "No, he just left." He says, "Oh no, I realized I should go talk to him because, you know, I told you I started this organization. We're lobbying for school safety standards. And she said that he's the most connected guy. She says, you know, are you going to see him again while you're here?" I said, "As a matter of fact, I made up to see him after the meal. Come see me after the meal." Great. Meal finishes. Max comes right over to me. "Can we go see the rabbi?" "Absolutely." We go in. Now the guys are back at the hotel. So we're going to do like a Q&A at night. All I want to do is get in, introduce Levi and Max, and get out. I do not want to get stuck there. We walk in. There's a woman who has just started telling a story. The other side, Levi's son, had married a girl from the Ukraine. So the woman telling the story is in like slightly broken English. They pull out two chairs because she's already started to speak and sit us down. And I am trapped. And I realize right away, this story is never going to end. It's never going to end. I'm like, can't believe this. And she's telling this story. And as I'm listening, I'm like, I'm looking at her like, this is a Sheva Brachas. Like, what is up, okay? She tells this crazy story about this really soldier, and he was friendly with this young boy, and then he went out to war, and he lost an arm, and then he came back, and he found out that the boy had died. I'm like, "Lady, this is a Sheva Brachas. What are you telling this story for?" And then years later, this soldier, he comes to New York, and somebody says to him, "You have to go to the Rebbe, to the Lubavitcher Rebbe. You have to go," and they make an appointment, and he goes in and speaks to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe gives him like all sorts of solace and comfort and advice, talks to him about the loss of his arm, and the Rebbe says to him, "But I know what's really been bothering you, and I want to tell you an answer." He says, "I know what's bothering you is, why did that young boy pass away? Why did God do that?" He said, "I'm going to tell you why. Because every single body has an neshama and has a soul, and every soul has a mission, and sometimes someone completes its mission quickly, and as soon as the mission's completed, they're taken up to heaven." Okay, now I'm sitting there. Max is next to me. I'm like, I cannot believe, like, obviously, he's here for these moments because he needs to hear this answer, right? So I lean over to Levi. I say, "Levi, you're not going to believe this. Was with me. I brought him here because he lost his son in the Parkland shooting. Started an organization. So he wanted to meet you. Like, do you believe she just told that story?" Okay. He says, he whispers back to me, "I was trying to figure out why she was telling that story." So he gets up to speak. Okay. Gives his Devar Torah. And he says, "I want to add something." He says, "I have here my dear chaver from when we were kids together, Harry Rothenberg. He's running a trip for Jewish men. And he brought along Max. Max has a very, very difficult story. Max lost his son in the Parkland slang. And it's obvious to me," he says, "and I want to tell you," he points to the woman, he says, "I don't know why you decided to tell the story, but I'm going to tell you why Hashem decided you should tell the story. Because Max needed to hear the answer of the Rebbe, and that's why you told that story right when Max walked into the room," okay? So Levi, all of a sudden, I see like his son is like pulling on his jacket. So he leans in. Yeah. Okay, he gets up, he says, "Okay, we have a rule that Chosin Doma Lamelech, during the week of Sheva Brachas, a chassan is compared to a king. If he says something, you have to listen. My son was just very taken by the story I said, so he'd like everybody in this room," there are about 40 people, it's a very big dinner, "to take on a mitzvah, le'iloi nishmas, the soul of Max's son." He asked Max, you know, for his son's name. So I'm completely blown away. And around this point, I realize, wait a minute. I notice, I'm like, wait a minute. I don't believe this. You know where we are? We're in the home of the people who are hosting our third meal for the next day on the trip, okay? So I introduce Max and Levi, we walk out. As soon as we walk out, Max says to me, "How did you arrange that?" I was like, "Max, how could I, if I was a professional, if I was Houdini, okay? I'm Harry Rothenberg, not Harry Houdini. How could I possibly, I didn't know you were going to walk up to me out of the blue and ask me to go to Levi's. We walked in together. She's in the middle of the story already before we walked in. How could I possibly have arranged that?" He's like, "How did that happen?" I was like, "Ask him." Like, it literally was Hashem going, "I got this. Max put a note in the wall. Why? He needs to hear the answer. I got this worked out." And you see moments like that are unbelievable. Statistically, it's at the nace level. So here's the amazing thing, though. You can influence this. You can actually influence this up in Shemayim. So what do I mean? And I'll finish with this. Just about. We'll see if we have time for another story after. But here's what I want to share with you. So Hashem tells the Yidden, has Moshe teach them the laws of Shemitah. Okay? You're going to go into the land, and you have to work. So Hashem says, for 6 years, I want you to plant and reap and eat until you're satisfied. And if you will ask, what will I eat during the seventh year? Don't worry, because in the sixth year, I'm going to give you a triple blessing, a triple bounty. The sixth year crop is going to be enough for the sixth year and the seventh year, even into the eighth year when you've had enough time to plant and to reap food. So don't worry. Great. So Rabbi Yashiv says, when would the Yidden have asked that question? What will I eat in the seventh year? When would they have asked it, right? Are they going to go into Eretz Yisrael after the conquest and then wait until the end of the sixth year? Hey, what are we going to eat next year? A little late to be asking that, right? He says they're going to ask it as soon as they get there. They're farmers. They're going to realize, hey, wait a minute, this is going real well. What are we going to eat in the seventh year? They're going to ask it in the first year, the second year, the third year, and the fourth year. And the answer is right there in the Torah. Don't worry. Sixth year, triple blessing. So hopefully every single Yid will trust that. But there could be a couple people, you know, worry warts. They haven't worked on their amunah. You know, just to be on the safe side, I'm going to squirrel away some food. I'm just going to keep a little extra food in the silo. Fine. Sixth year comes, everybody gets a triple blessing. So that's it. The people that trusted Hashem, they get the triple blessing. Great. The people that didn't trust Hashem, they get the triple blessing. Great. So the next time around, they're going to say, oh, how do you like that? I didn't need the store. Hashem came through. Next time, I don't need to, you know, to squirrel away any food. He says, you think that Hashem put this question in the Torah? What will I eat in the seventh year? Because one time in history it was going to be asked. During the first 6 years they were in Eretz Yisrael? No. He says, this question was asked over and over and over and over again, and it's still being asked now. Why? Because here's what happened. The sixth year came. The people that trusted Hashem, they understood that when Hashem said, for 6 years, I want you to plant and reap and eat until you're satisfied. That wasn't a prediction. That was a command. Eat until you're satisfied. If you're on a diet, that's fine. If you're working on your meat dose, like some saying, you're leaving over a little bit, that's fine. But if you are storing food because you don't trust me, I see that. Guess what? When I get to the sixth year, you're not getting the triple blessing. I don't do nisim for people that don't trust me. You decided to squirrel away food. You're on your own. Use the food you squirreled away. Hashem, you said there was going to be a triple bounty. Yeah, I did. And you showed me that you didn't believe me. So you don't get that. And so how does that manifest? And so now the next set of years, right? The person that squirreled away food is like, oh, good thing I saved food. He didn't come through. Of course he didn't come through. You showed him that you didn't trust him, so he didn't come through. He's not doing a miracle for you when you're showing him that I don't trust him. So how does that manifest itself nowadays? For those of us who are in business, you know, I know that Hashem put a number next to my name on Rosh Hashanah of how much money I'm going to make, but obviously, you know, we're shutfim. I mean, I got to help him out here. I mean, there's no way I'm going to make that number if I don't, you know, cut corners a little bit in business. I mean, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. I mean, come on, I got to cheat on my taxes a little bit. Otherwise, how am I going to get to that number? You think Hashem is saying, I'm writing a number next to your name, but come on, this is only if you cheat on your taxes. I mean, if you don't cheat on your taxes, I'm not giving you that number. You think that's how Hashem works? If you cheat on your taxes, you're telling Hashem, I don't trust you. Oh, you don't trust me? Right? It's going to happen. So the more you show Hashem, I trust you. I am not going to cut corners. I'm not going to finagle. I'm not going to play games because you said that, you know, aser to aser. You said in Malachi, the one thing, that if you give to the test me, it's the only mitzvah for which he says this, test me, give tzedakah and see if I don't open the storehouses of heaven. So the more you show Hashem that I trust you, the more likely you are to merit an open miracle. And I'll just finish with an example of this. I had a client who, very difficult case, And the before trial, the offer started increasing substantially, even though for years they were telling me, we'll never pay you anything. And finally, the offer reached, I figured it was going to tap out at like $750. It reached $1 million. So I said to the client, you have to take this. Like, I rarely say this. You cannot go to trial. There is no way we may not even make it past the judge. Like, you might lose half this money on summary judgment. We're not getting into the details. He gets back to me. He says, Harry, you're religious, right? I said, yeah. Okay, wasn't Jewish. He says, I'm deeply religious, and I spoke to God, and God told me I should go to trial. I shouldn't accept the money. I said, look, I'm just, you know, no offense, but I think God's telling you that you really ought to listen to a lawyer who's very experienced in the field, and you ought to take the money. He says, no. So we show up. This is only a couple days before trial. We show up at the trial. And the other side, what do you mean he didn't take it? He says, look, that's what's going on. So the judge says, what's going on? I say to the judge, we spent a lot of time haggling over this. We got to their final number. And it's a number really that everybody in the room agrees is an appropriate number. But my client says that he spoke to God and he wants to go to trial. So the judge rolls up his sleeves. He he went and spoke to my client. Very, very tragic story, what had happened. And he said, you know what, I am going to see what I can do. I'm going to see if I can do anything. And the judge himself, which did not happen that often, especially the eve of trial, rolled up his sleeves and pressured the other side. They came up with another $100,000. And then he took it. Then he accepted it. Okay, so I couldn't believe this, right? Here, he's telling me, I'm the guy with the yarmulke on my head. Do you believe in God? Of course I believe in God. Is it God telling me to say no? I'm like, dude, God is not telling you to say no, okay? God's telling you to take the million, right? Gets another $100,000, okay? So he said to me afterwards, he said, you have to understand something. What had happened in the accident was he lost his wife. When I lost my wife, I had nothing. I had nowhere to turn. So I put all of my faith in God. And the Rambam says that the more you believe in Hashem, Rambam doesn't distinguish, by the way, it's very interesting. It doesn't say, if you're a Yid, the more you believe in Hashem, the more you're going to get back. It's directly proportional. The more we show, I trust you and I put my faith in you. Of course, we need guidance, you know, from our Rebbeim, what that means in different areas, the more you'll get back. Hatzlacha, let's all put our faith in Hashem this year on Yom Kippur, and Mirtz Hashem, we'll get a tremendous amount back in this coming year. Thanks for listening, and Gemar Chesima Tovet, everyone.